Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with White House plans to privatize the war in Afghanistan following a proposal by Eric Prince, the brother of Betsy DeVos and founder of the mercenary army Blackwater, along with Steven Feinberg, the billionaire hedge fund owner of the military and intelligence contractor DynCorp, that Stephen Bannon and Jared Kushner are championing. A biographer of Eric Prince, Robert Young Pelton, the author of License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, joins us to discuss what is called the Laos option, to turn over the fate and future of Afghanistan to a CIA shadow army largely made up of foreign mercenaries, thus reducing American boots on the ground and providing Trump with an exit strategy from nation building, a concept that Stephen Bannon abhors. Then we will speak with Alexander Klimberg, a program director at the Hague Center for Strategic Studies, about his new book just out, The Darkening Web, The War for Cyberspace. He joins us to discuss the weaponization of information and the global struggle over the future of the internet, with democracies wanting to keep the internet free and open, while autocracies like China and Russia argue for sovereign control of information using appeals to nationalism to control their populations through censorship and propaganda. Then finally, we'll examine a rare victory in the Congress for decency and human rights following a surprise vote in the House to block U.S. participation in the Saudi war on Yemen. Kate Gould, the legislative representative for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C., joins us to discuss the two amendments to the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, that passed overwhelmingly. And joining us now is Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Hi.
And you, of course, were commissioned by Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, the brother of Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education. The mercenary army, of course, Blackwater, was in Iraq. It got into a lot of trouble, massacring a bunch of people, Iraqi innocents, and the State Department cut its contract with him. But since then, Eric Prince has formed a mercenary army in the Emirates in the Gulf. But what we're learning now is that he, along with the billionaire hedge fund owner Steven Feinberg, have lobbied the White House and Stephen Bannon to privatize the war in Afghanistan. And is this an attempt, do you think, on the part of the Trump administration to sort of find an exit strategy so that they don't have to continue what I understand Stephen Bannon deplores, which is nation building?
Well, first of all, if people remember my book, License to Kill, the very first chapter is me meeting Eric at the Ritz-Carlton, and he lays out this idea he has of an army. He called it Relief with Peace, but it's a self-contained mercenary army of about 1,700 people that he wanted to send into Darfur to put down the Janjaweed. Now, since then, he's done that in a number of places, both theoretically and physically. So he's done it in Somalia with the Puntland Marine anti-piracy forces. He's done it with reflex responses in the UAE to fight in Yemen. And he tried it in South Sudan, and he wants to do it in Libya, et cetera, et cetera. These armies don't actually do what they're supposed to do. They're sort of shock troops. Now, yes, you can get 1,700 people with air support, and you can go in and chase terrorist groups, but it doesn't rebuild a nation. It doesn't bring security. So his idea is grossly misrepresented as a way to fix something. And in actual fact, it is more of a punitive or shock troop idea.
So, in other words, they're the tip of the spear. They prod a few times at the Taliban, but there's no follow-up.
Correct. So he wanted to go into Nigeria and charge $300 million to chase Boko Haram and get those girls, and they sort of laughed at him, and his South African mercenaries did it cheaper. and faster, but that doesn't end terrorism in Nigeria. You know, there's still piracy in Somalia, and any sort of shock troop or elite force of sort of mercenaries and sepoys would have zero effect on the government of Afghanistan. It doesn't make tribes sit down and talk things over. It does just the opposite.
Well, but isn't there a fundamental problem with Afghanistan? And I don't know whether the George W. Bush people saw it initially, but we've had two failed administrations, one dominated by neoconservatives, the Bush administration, and the other with an opposite view, the Obama administration, and both have totally failed. And isn't at the end of the day, apart from the fact that the Pakistanis basically sabotage everything because they want to control whatever happens in Afghanistan. At the end of the day, this is not a country that is self-sustaining, is it? It's always going to be a rentier country, isn't it?
Yeah, Afghanistan has always been one of the poorest countries on earth, and Pakistan has always treated it like its backyard. And the idea that Pakistan has is, if we make Afghanistan ungovernable, then India will never roll into Pakistan because then they'll have to deal with the Afghans. But keep in mind, we're fighting two wars in Afghanistan. We're fighting an anti-terrorism war, or CT war, counterterrorism, which is well-funded and actually very successful in wiping out ISIS and al-Qaeda units. And then we're also supporting what they call Resolute Support, which is the NATO effort to stabilize and train troops. Now, once again, Afghan commandos with U.S. training and support do very, very well against the Taliban. And this is something that's not coming out in media reports because we sort of lost interest in Afghanistan. So I go to Afghanistan all the time, and I spend time with their counterterrorism people and go on missions with the commandos. We are actually doing exactly what we said we would do, which was create a 400,000-man security force that can put down uprisings or insurgents, you know, like the Taliban. The question is, why are we doing it and how long do we want to do it for?
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Young Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography is The Adventurist. And as I mentioned in the beginning, you were actually hired by Eric Prince to do a biography on him, so you know him pretty well. But I cannot for the life of me see how this proposal by the hedge fund billionaire who owns DynCorp, I think it's the biggest defense and intelligence contractor, Steven Feinberg, and Eric Prince, the founder of the Blackwater Mercenary Army and has this army in the Emirates in the Gulf, this is the most self-serving proposal I've ever heard. I mean, these guys are going to make a ton of money, aren't they?
Well, okay, so they're like cleaning services. When you want to clean your house, they come in and clean, but they don't own the house. And when they went to see General Mattis on Saturday, General Mattis quite wisely cocked one eyebrow at them and said, thanks, but no thanks. You know, contract services are always a support element. They don't replace the main military or government efforts in country. And you have to remember, Blackwater only exists because we had a leaning forward diplomatic policy under George Bush in Iraq, where we would take these poor, terrified 20-something diplomats around in convoys at 80 miles an hour, dodging VBIDs. So we invented that for Blackwater to prosper from. We don't necessarily need to recreate that.
Well, but these mercenary armies, if indeed Stephen Bannon and Jared Kushner have their way, and they certainly have the ear of Donald Trump. I'm not sure whether Mattis and McMaster really do have the ear of Donald Trump. A lot of people find comfort in the fact that there are these two adults in the room, but I'm not even sure that they're in the room. But these contractors' armies are mostly foreigners, aren't they? They're Gurkhas, yeah, and other nations. So isn't there already a kind of moral hazard? Not to, one, you already have mercenaries, and who do they answer to? And two, they're not even American.
Yeah, so let's get something clear. When Eric Prince starts doing bad history, saying that the East India Company and hiring a viceroy is somehow a success model for Afghanistan, it's actually proven to be not successful. Secondly, it was part of the colonial takeover of the world by the British Empire, using mercantile hirees to use local sepoys who would then run amok around the population and do what they have to do, then the government would step in and say, thank you, we'll take it from here. So it's a ludicrous historical concept and is being promoted by a guy who has numerous times shown that once you give him the keys to the car, he drives it into the wall and smashes it and then walks away unscathed. But we still have to deal with the accident.
Well, but DynCorp, for example, Feinberg's operation, they've already been paid $2.5 billion by the State Department for what they've done in Afghanistan. So that's what I'm talking about. The amount of money here is extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, but okay, keep in mind that Dick Cheney came up with this idea for expeditionary warfare. So when he wrote this paper that he had Brown and Root, which is now DynCorp, the idea was is that we were no longer fighting World War II. We might fight in two or three places at one time. So we would send a Halliburton to build all the bases, cook the food, flatten the runways, et cetera. Troops would come in, do their thing like they did in Somalia, and then leave. And then Brown and Root or Halliburton would tear down everything and go home, which is exactly what happened in Somalia in 1993. We've been at war for over two decades. And you could argue that we've been at war since the 80s in Afghanistan. And that's not expeditionary warfare. That is full-time warfare. So it doesn't make sense, to rent something at a high rate when we could just build it ourselves or have the Afghans do it.
But my understanding is that the pitch that Eric Prince gave to Stephen Bannon and Jared Kushner was based upon an op-ed that he wrote back in May in the Wall Street Journal. But essentially, it's been described as the Laos option, where the CIA brings in a shadowy army like they did in Laos, which, of course, was left in ruins. And that's the whole idea, isn't it? That they become the lead agency and that the army and the Marines get out?
Yeah, he's trying to reconstruct some mythical war that people like Tony Poe operated with, like Air America, which was sort of what Eric does now, is set up fake companies to allow the agency and JSOC to operate in Africa. And they went in with Hmong mercenaries, and they had unlimited budgets, et cetera, et cetera. This is not how America needs to conduct warfare in Afghanistan. You can conduct it that way in Pakistan and take your lumps in a nuclear country with a huge population. But his sense of history is all backwards and upside down. There is a functioning government in Afghanistan that will not tolerate a CIA-run sort of covert operation murdering civilians under the guise of being peacekeepers or mercenaries. And keep in mind, Eric is not a mercenary. He would be a contractor to the United States. And just like in Iraq, where they kicked Blackwater out and we lost the status of forces agreement, there are serious consequences for bringing in contractors who run amok of the law.
Right. And of course, going back to Air America in Laos during the Vietnam War, there were all kinds of rumors about them getting involved in the opium trade. And there's no shortage of opium in Afghanistan.
Well, no, there's not a rumor. That was true. And also it happened with the Contras in Nicaragua, in which the people that they used were also involved in the drug smuggling business. So that's not a myth. It actually happened. Just like when we bankrolled the Mujahideen, they were bringing rockets in on mules and camels, but they were also bringing opium gum out on the way back.
Sure. Well, I'm not going to defend Stephen Bannon, but he has apparently questioned the $850 billion in non-military spending that the U.S. has poured into Afghanistan so far. And they don't have a lot to show for it, right?
Well, I disagree. I was in Afghanistan with what they call CRU-222, a counterterrorism unit that has over 7,000 people on their payroll. And you remember the hospital assault where they went in, ISIS went in and murdered people in the hospital. These people are just as adept and as elite as some of the First World Forces now because of that training and because of the support. So I disagree with the idea that Afghanistan is this sort of swamp of failure. I would say that we wanted to be that so we can cut ties and move on. And I would question what is our strategic role in Afghanistan, but we still haven't gotten rid of Al-Qaeda and ISIS and those empty spaces we talked about. Mm-hmm. So we can have a lot more intelligent conversation when you remove the funding that we already agreed to basically bankroll the army, police, and those institutions, and then look at the counterterrorism mission, which is the one that we're really focused on in terms of killing bad people.
Right, but I was talking more about not so much the military side of it. And, of course, there has been a problem with the, blue on green or killing.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I was focusing on the kind of hearts and minds idea that my understanding is when the U.S. first went in there, a lot of Afghans thought, my God, you know, these are the guys that put a man on the moon. Finally, you know, somebody's going to save our country. And for the average Afghan, I don't know how much life has improved. And I wonder whether they all joined the Taliban because they've been intimidated into it, or whether the Taliban through the Pashtun tribe, has.
But here's the need for accurate history. In November of 2001, because I was there, we brought in special forces teams to support local ethnic groups, warlords, leaders, whatever. We then coordinated air attacks, and we got the Taliban to surrender within 3 weeks. In other words, the war was over. And then, for some strange reason, the State Department stepped in and decided to rebuild or remake Afghanistan. And this is where this massive avalanche of money came in, and then the corruption. And we essentially funded the Taliban by them taxing all these infrastructure projects. So there's more than just like black and white in how we've won and lost in Afghanistan. And I don't think Steve Bannon is the right guy to be calling the shots on that. I think the Afghan government and people would have a say in how we engage with them to free their country from violence.
Right, but like all of our proxies during the Cold War, like the crooks in Vietnam and Somoza in Nicaragua, and you go through this whole sorry list to Marcos in the Philippines, it doesn't seem like we've done well with the Karzai family, and it seems as if the current leader, Ghani, even though he's well-meaning, seems a little feckless. And my understanding is that, you know, there's rumors of a possible coup attempt against him. So give us a sense of what kind of political stability we have in terms of the government itself.
Yeah, so you're correct that, you know, Ghani, like Karzai, is ridiculed as the mayor of Kabul, trapped within his palace on the grounds there. The regional leaders have formed another alliance, the ethnic leaders like Dostum and the various tribes all the way up to the Panjshiris, have created a secondary political machine that they want to challenge Ghani with in the elections. And the people out in the country, just like you would expect, don't really see a lot of difference. But, you know, Kabul itself and Mazar are massive urban complexes with technology and jobs, et cetera, et cetera. The part about the Taliban is usually way out in the hinterlands where nobody goes. And so, yes, you're seeing the lack of clearing the Taliban, but the Taliban are also a mechanism to get attention from the government to get funding. So I wouldn't be black and white on Afghanistan, and I also wouldn't say that we automatically have to go to Afghanistan to save them, because then you've got Yemen, then you've got Somalia, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's up to the Afghans to decide what they want Afghanistan to be, and they're also getting significant support from the EU. So for now, everything is being held together. The military is clearing out the Taliban. Ghani hasn't been deposed yet, but there are storm clouds brewing, and that has to be part of the discussion, because sending somebody like Eric Prinsen or DynCorp, which changes oils and generators, it does not solve the underlying problems inside Afghanistan.
But can you solve the underlying problem in Afghanistan, which is Pakistan?
No, you can't. So, Pakistan is a nuclear nation. It has a significantly higher population. It sits on a violent rift line between India and South Asia, and we're always playing patty cake. I mean, they were the ones that essentially created the Taliban. They're the ones that harbored bin Laden. They still harbor numerous violent groups, including ISIS. So do we want to go to war with Pakistan just to make a point? Once again, what's our self-interest in that region?
Right, but Pakistan's been playing this duplicitous game with us all along, pretending to be an ally, stabbing us in the back, and we've thrown a lot of money at them, and they use their nuclear arsenal as a kind of weapon, if you will, to extort money on the basis that we can't allow our weapons to fall into the hands of the radicals, the same people that they secretly fund.
Right, and taking Donald Trump at face value, which is that he's going to focus on Amero-centric policies. In other words, does it benefit America? The only major evil I see is that they will erase all those things you just talked about and say, can we make more money by revving up the defense industry, by the contracting industry? Don't forget, this is an industry that hires white middle-aged males primarily from the heartland of the flyover states, and it's a vote winner for Trump supporters if suddenly you're putting 30,000, 50,000, 100,000 contractors with military experience or sort of technology skills into a place like Afghanistan. So that's my biggest concern, is that this may not be about Afghanistan at all. It may be just about jobs and revving up what is a uniquely American industry, which is the defense industry.
Yeah, which is throwing a bone to your white nationalist base, which is the people that Stephen Bannon champions. So right. I get your point. I think that that's probably the ultimately the real subtext here. And
let's look at one thing else. Let's look at a potential war with Iran and how these people fit into that scenario. And that's my biggest warning to people, is keep your eye on the real prize, which is you need to depose Iran by having as many troops as possible in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And you need people like Eric Prince, who was physically hired to start a war in Iran back in the Iraq days, to be your useful fool. That's my biggest concern.
Right, but would Mattis be that crazy to have a war? I mean, I know he's anti-Iran, and I know American military and intelligence people have a big grudge against Iran for all that great Satan insanity, but he's got to be a little smarter than that.
No, let's remember, James Mattis is actually a man who's been in combat and has seen people die under his command. Eric Prince has lost employees. And he has never been in combat. He's not a leader of men in combat. James Mattis takes his job very responsibly and speaks very plainly. So I actually trust Mattis to call BS on any plan that comes from Bennett. But like you say, does anybody hear him say that? Or does he get overridden? Then we sneak it in through this slush funding that Mike Flynn wanted to get rid of in the CIA and JSOC.
Right. Well, Robert Young-Pelton, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine, has had firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography is The Adventurist. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with the author of the new book just out, The Darkening Web, The War for Cyberspace.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind discs. I just don't want you 100%.
Adobe error. Be careful with the downloading. Protect your eyes. Protect yourself from digital decay. Digital decay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Alexander Klimberg, who's a program director at the Hague Center for Strategic Studies and a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and an associate and former fellow at the Belfer Center of Harvard's Kennedy School. He has acted as an advisor to a number of governments and international organizations on cybersecurity strategy and internet governance, and has participated in various national, international, NATO, and EU policy groups. His latest book just out is The Darkening Web, The War for Cyberspace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Klimberg.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And, of course, we have so many wars over the internet at the moment. Only a few days ago, all the big internet companies like Google, Amazon, and Facebook, etc., had a day-long day of action to try and prevent the Trump administration from going ahead and basically destroying net neutrality and, in effect, commercializing the internet and turning it into the kind of horrible service that we have on cable TV. And of course, you've brought to the table the broader landscape of the battle between the forces of free internet, the democracies around the world who favor an unconstrained flow of information independent of national borders and cultural barriers, and then the cyber sovereignty camp led by Russia and China, who want to control the internet and use nationalism to control their populations through censorship and propaganda. So this is a big subject, and your book is very important and very welcome. So I thank you for it.
Thank you very much for the comments.
And let's start then with the broader landscape in terms of this battle between the democracies and the autocracies over the future of the internet. It obviously has a governance structure now, and at the moment it's still free and open. So how would you handicap these forces? Do you think the dark side, to use the Star Wars analogy, the Russians and the Chinese are going to win? And not that our side is, the hands aren't completely clean, because there are forces in this country who would like to, in the name of combating hacking, etc., they would like to have more control over the internet too. So it's not so black and white, but how would you handicap the situation now?
Well, as you said, it's not only Russia and China that are following a pure national interest here. Other governments are slowly picking up this type of narrative. Even in the UK, Theresa May announced that the formerly known mother of all democracies was going to consider a level of content control and data control that would have been second only to China. She even said she wanted the UK to take a leading role in data regulation. This was a great shock to many people in Europe and the UK. And I think it just goes to show you that even real stand-up members of liberal democratic society and the values community can suddenly change direction very quickly. And I think it's important that we realize that they change direction, these governments, precisely because they are triggered to do so by political incidents that are usually cast as cyber incidents. So a cyber incident happens, like WannaCry or NotPetya, and the call goes out for a government to do something. And do something usually means something knee-jerk, like regulate it in a way that it can't be regulated, or establish content controls that are really in no way part of what the internet was really intended to be, or similarly get involved in a level of technical control that the internet simply won't allow the way it's currently set up. And this is really what the authoritarian states really want to have. They want governments in the West to accept their narrative that only governments can determine what the internet is about, because if we let governments determine what the internet is about, then we're also letting them determine what free speech is about. And that is why I consider the discussion so important, because we can't have free speech if we don't have a free internet.
Well, but it seems like the internet's under attack for different reasons, in effect, and its great potential from the very beginning, for example, the great potential for the internet to become a font of information and enlightenment has clearly not been realized. In many ways, you can argue, at least in this country, the United States, the internet has become a conduit for trivia.
Hmm. So that's, of course, always a matter of personal observation and personal preference. I would think that the internet has been a great boon to our lives. I personally think that it's been a greatly expanded personal freedoms, and it's done a lot for personal and economic productivity. And of course, it has induced a whole new range of risks that we have to deal with. It also introduced a whole new currency, how we pay for these services. Namely, we provide our data. And we have to have a conversation to what extent that currency should be regulated. How do we provide the data? What rights do we have to that data? But we also need to keep in mind that governments have a different interest than monetizing our information. They want to use that information for national security purposes. And in some cases, we can see that national security purposes are justified, and we can say that sometimes they're not justified, and that the only thing that really determines the difference is the legitimacy that we give them as democratic citizens. If a democracy decides that it's necessary to engage in information control on a level that Theresa May proposed, then it's very hard to disagree with it on a legal level, although morally I think it's a very bad thing to do. However, what we do have is that countries like China, for instance, are developing the internet as a surveillance mechanism. They've managed to jump the big, great firewall problem, how to protect their cyberspace from unwanted information outside, and are now actively using cyberspace to monitor and control their own citizens. And this provides a little bit of indication of where the rest of the internet could go in the worst case in 10 or 15 years if we allow the slow drift towards government control to happen. I don't think it's likely, I like to point out, but it could happen, and it would be a disaster of epic proportions.
Well, my critique about Trivia was to do with its potential at not having been realized. You know, I mean, obviously, there's been a massive boon in all kinds of ways. But when you mention, Alexander Klimberg, that totalitarian or authoritarian countries using the internet and monetizing it, of course, Google and Facebook and others have really monetized it. There is a phenomenon known as surveillance capitalism, isn't there?
Absolutely. That's why I said that and Facebook, for instance, even can provide a service, as far as I'm aware, to help you do counterintelligence based on Facebook's observed activity of what people are doing and looking at your profile and looking at your friends and similar. So a lot of these companies have opened up the fields for counterintelligence, even for the average individual. The average individual can go and try to get additional information as who is looking up their information for what purposes. But to get back to your point, I think the overall assessment of how good the internet has been for us as a whole is a big conversation. For me personally, I think it's been a universal good. It has drawbacks, just like the introduction of the printing press had drawbacks, or the introduction of the wheel had drawbacks. And I do think you are certainly right, and I would agree with that so much more could be made of it. But what I am absolutely sure of is that we're not going to make more of it if we agree that information overall is a weapon that needs to be controlled. And that is the one narrative that I am most concerned with. Everything else, in terms of what the development aspects of the internet are, how we can include the next billion of people on this planet that are about to join the internet over the next 10 years, and how we can just basically do more good with it, I think those are extremely worthy conversations that are had in many different formats. My primary concern is just to make sure we don't go the other direction.
And again, I'm speaking with Alexander Klimberg, a program director at the Hague Center for Strategic Studies and a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and an associate and former fellow at the Belfer Center of Harvard's Kennedy School. He's acted as an advisor to a number of governments and international organizations on cybersecurity strategy and internet governance, and has participated in various national, international, NATO and EU policy groups. And his latest book just out is The Darkening Web: The War for Cyberspace. So we've talked a little bit about how in the West we have problems with the internet, and as much as here in the United States it could become commercialized by the big telecom monopolies under getting rid of net neutrality, which the Trump administration and their FCC head Ajit Pai want to do at the behest of the big monopolies, and that would be a catastrophe, particularly for the business I'm in, the news and information business. We have enough trouble with newspapers going out of business and losing readerships, largely because of the internet. And without the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, I don't think we'd be finding out what the Trump administration is up to. So there's all kinds of implications there. But let's turn to the other side, the dark side, if you will, with China and Russia, but in particular Russia. They have developed a form of hybrid warfare. They've weaponized information both to brainwash their own people, but also to influence and manipulate the democracies in Europe and here in the United States, in terms of what they apparently tried to do in tipping the election for Donald Trump. What is scary about it, and your book brings this out, The Darkening Web, The War for Cyberspace, Alexander Klimberg, is you make the analogy with nuclear war versus cyber war. At this point, it is sort of below the threshold of war, but it's just as aggressive and just as damaging, and arguably going after the foundation of American democracy by interfering with our elections is a pretty hostile act. So walk us through where we stand in terms of that envelope being pushed.
So it comes down to what is your nightmare? And it used to be that we had one common nightmare. That nightmare was that of the mushroom cloud. It bound us all together, and when we had state-to-state discussions on strategic arms control, it was quite clear there was one outcome that everybody really wanted to avoid, and that was a nuclear holocaust. Today, we don't have one nightmare. We have two nightmares. Yes, we have the one potential nightmare of an all-out cyber war that wrecks critical infrastructure and basically puts us back in either the 1920s or the Iron Age, depending on your flavor. But we also have another nightmare, which is the nightmare of authoritarian states, which is nothing else than the loss of control of their information space. Since they conceive of this information space as being a weapon, as we talked about beforehand, they are also well-versed in information warfare. Now, information warfare campaigns themselves are not terribly new. The Soviet Union was doing them nonstop in the Cold War. And indeed, in the last 5-6 years, many European countries, not only European countries, have experienced the full force of Russian information warfare campaigns. However, the big question was, why were they so less effective? Sweden, Finland, Estonia, Germany, most notably France, in terms of their elections, they were hit by information warfare campaigns. It didn't have anything like the results it had in the U.S., if indeed we agree that they played a decisive role in the election. Now, the question would be, why did that happen? And I can tell you that it wasn't the level of resources dedicated to it. The level of resources dedicated to some of the Scandinavian countries was much higher. But the Scandinavians didn't fold, quite the opposite. I think the question is, and I raise this in the book, is why was the United States a soft target for these types of attempts? And I think that one of the solutions is simply the level of trust that the U.S. populace as a whole has in their institutions. As I mentioned in the book, a Gallup poll that has been conducted every year for the last 15 or 20 years tracks the popularity or the level of trust of the U.S. public in their institutions. And only 20% apparently really believe that the mainstream media, as it was called, was doing a good job, but only 6% thought that the U.S. Congress was doing a good job. 6%. I mean, it's really hard to believe that any country can survive not having a revolution when only 6% of the population thinks it's doing a good job. Now, the question is, why did this happen? I don't think personally, and I don't think many other people would say, that the U.S. Congress is incredibly dysfunctional or that the entire political system is so poor to rate that badly. So the question arises, how did we get in the United States to a level where the public trust is that bad in those institutions? Was it simply because they do such a bad job, which I think most people would say cannot be that bad, or were there other factors in play? That's a different discussion to find out why this trust has been weakened, intentionally or not, in the U.S. institutions. But what's definitely sure is that those weak numbers, that weak level of trust in those institutions, made it much easier to influence the U.S. in an election. If it was decisive or not, it's a different question.
Well, that is, of course, the big question about our nation here and whether we can survive without a consensus on what is real. I mean, that's the most appalling fact of all, that there's no basic consensus about facts anymore.
Absolutely.
That people do what they call reality shopping. And it's really frightening that how can you deal with the challenges we face unless there's a national consensus about what is real and what is true. But Surkov and Putin and the Russians have created the art of deliberately creating false news, have they not? And fake news is something that Trump has used, but they turn it back against the mainstream media by accusing them of being fake news. So isn't that what's happening here?
So the point that I also mentioned in the book, and which you just brought up, and I very much agree with you, is that it's been reported by people who follow this closer, much more closer than I do, that the Russian propaganda strategy is very concrete and can be summarized in one word, which is to create the plurality of truths, to create the impression that there is no such thing as an objective truth, there's only subjective truths, and therefore everything is possible. And the intent here is not only simply to cast everyone as being equally bad, which also, of course, provides more freedom for you if you want to be a bad actor, but it also does something much more insidious, which is what you're addressing, which is that it weakens the general quality of the word fact itself. And the analysis that I've read and the experts that I've spoken to on the subject all universally agree that the intent is not to create other stories. The intent is to weaken the trust, generally speaking, in all stories whatsoever. And that's a different strategy, and it's a lot more complex, and it involves a lot of really interesting moves, like picking up on all conspiracy theories, from UFOs to alien origins of history, and giving them a platform to undermine the more consensus narrative of those issues. So what it boils down to is that there is, and there has been for a long time, a specific attack on the nature of fact, of something that we would call an objective truth, for 70 or 80% of the things that we discussed today. The question that you are ever additionally posing is, do we not do that partially to ourselves through the Google bubble of only, or the Facebook bubble of only looking up comments that we believe in anyway, or listening to political comments that we would only want to listen to anyway? So this idea of working in a bubble where you effectively only get the Facebook comments that your friends post, or people, the algorithms think you might be interested in, and they don't expose you to other algorithms, or sorry, to other posts, is another problem. It's a problem of the algorithms themselves. It's basically a very insidious spiral where effectively you are fed on a diet based on your assumed preferences. This person likes stuff about Hillary Clinton. Let's feed them more stuff about Hillary Clinton. You won't actually get in your bubble, be that in social media or from search engines, information that contradicts that. You'll just get more of that. And that's a much deeper problem that I don't think has a human or originator. I think we just brought it upon ourselves, and how we solve that problem might be even more difficult than solving the so-called information warfare issue.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Alexander Klimberg, is there a possibility that we can demand and get algorithmic accountability?
So this is a very big topic that has only recently started to be addressed. The reason why it is so difficult is that many of these algorithms that effectively control nearly every aspect of our life are not written by humans anymore. They're actually written by machines themselves. And to make it even more bizarre, we don't exactly know what they do. So to put it this way, if you wanted as a tribunal to understand, to say to Facebook, for instance, how does your algorithm actually work? How does it actually make suggestions on what people should view? They will provide you a general answer, but they can't provide you a really complete answer. So the only way we can fix this is effectively by insisting that certain factors are added to the code. So when the code continues to write itself, it will consider those factors. And those factors have to be principles. And they can be a principle, for instance, like, well, don't feed somebody only that what you think they want to see. Feed them something else. Feed them something outside of their bubble. That could be a principle, for instance, that you could bake into code. But you couldn't actually write the code every single time new, because it's generated new all the time based on the responses of the users. So the actual monitoring and managing of these algorithms that really do manage huge chunks, not only of our self-education and our entertainment, but really of our lives, is such a huge issue. We haven't even begun having this conversation yet, and it might involve a whole new set of actors as well as set of technical principles that we need to examine.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Alexander Klimberg.
Thank you very much for your time.
And again, I've been speaking with Alexander Klimberg, who's a program director at the Hague Center for Strategic Studies, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and an associate and former fellow at the Belfast Center of Harvard University's Kennedy School. He has acted as an advisor to a number of governments and international organizations on cybersecurity strategy and internet governance, and has participated in various national, international, NATO, and EU policy groups. His latest book just out is The Darkening Web, The War for Cyberspace. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into a rare victory in the Congress for Decency and Human Rights following a surprise vote in the House to block U.S. participation in the Saudi war on Yemen. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kate Gould, the Legislative Representative for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies on Iran and Israel-Palestinian peace. And welcome to Background Briefing, Kate Gould.
Thanks for having me back.
And it's not often that the Congress does the right thing, but it seems like they've done the decent and right thing here, particularly in terms of human rights, in this vote that took place with the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, a couple of amendments passed which block U.S. participation in the Saudi war in Yemen. We also had a pretty tight, close vote on the big sale of arms to Saudi Arabia. But it's clear that our president, he loves the boy king and the Saudis, and he even took credit for this ill-conceived attack on Qatar that the young boy king has done. And it's the same young boy king, of course, who prosecuted the war in Yemen and, by all accounts, has bitten off more than he can chew. So you're working there in the trenches on Capitol Hill. You must feel good about this, Kate.
It is certainly good to see that momentum is growing in Congress. There is a lot of pushback, bipartisan pushback. So Republicans and Democrats are saying that this this carte blanche kind of policy, you know, giving the Saudis a blank check for weapons, for wars, for these various wars, for new conflicts, of course, now with Qatar, that has to be reined in. And so, and it really can't, you know, come soon enough for the situation in Yemen. I mean, we're talking about a crisis that the UN has said is the world's largest humanitarian crisis, a cholera, outbreak that is now the world's largest cholera outbreak that is infecting a child every 35 seconds. I mean, this is, and killing somebody in Yemen every 35 minutes. I mean, this is really a devastating war. And so it's great to see that there's definitely, you know, congressional momentum opposing this war, opposing U.S. military involvement that is on the upswing. And we have to really seize that momentum and end this war altogether and stop U.S. enabling of Saudi and Emirati war crimes.
But the vote was pretty overwhelming, wasn't it?
Yes, so it was quite a surprise and really good to see that last week, as you said, with the National Defense Authorization Act, so this is the military policy bill. This is one of the most important pieces of national security legislation that Congress passes each year. And whereas, you know, you can't bet on most legislation passing, this always passes. And so it's really an important debate. And there's always a slew of amendments added to it on various national security issues. And so we had one Republican and one Democrat both submit amendments that would really limit, and in one case prohibit altogether any kind of military involvement with the Saudi-led Yemen war. So, and what happened is that those were that the House Armed Services Committee, that Republican leadership actually agreed to allow that to be wrapped in en bloc, which means that they put these amendments that are seen as non-controversial, and then Congress votes on them all at once. So it was overwhelming. I mean, everybody who was voting for the bill itself was voting for those amendments. So it wasn't a specific vote, a roll call vote specifically on the Yemen amendment, but rather, and even more surprisingly, it was an amendment that was wrapped in as considered to be a non-controversial issue and wrapped into the House bill. It's going to be, it's going to take a lot of work to get something really strong and binding in the Senate, but I think we have a real chance that we just haven't had before. It's a great opportunity.
Now, how will this actually impact the Saudi war? Because the Saudi Air Force has been bombing indiscriminately. And by the way, they targeted a lot of heritage sites because of this Wahhabi influence that's so peculiar in how the Islamic, how the Muslim faith has been, how the Islamic faith has been so affected by this reactionary, austere, anti-Western view of Islam. like these characters in these Daesh, the Islamic State, they destroy museums and ancient cities like Palmyra in Syria under the guise of being against idolatry. So there's been an awful lot of not just destruction of human life, and you mentioned the cholera epidemic, but there's also been this horrible situation with the destruction of antiquities as well. But let me just get an understanding, though, because my understanding is that the bombing campaign of both the Saudis and the UAE aircraft, they're largely refueled by U.S. aircraft, are they not?
That's right. Yes, they are. And as Senator Chris Murphy put it, he said the Saudis simply could not operate this bombing campaign without us. Their planes cannot fly without U.S. refueling capacity. But then we also saw there was an interview recently with CENTCOM spokesperson about the refueling and asking a reporter from The Intercept asked about what kind of precautions are being taken to ensure that we're not actually fueling these planes that then go on to bomb civilian targets, to bomb other, you know, to bomb these food warehouses and sanitation facilities and all, and antiquity sites. And I mean, what kind of tracking mechanism is there? And he responded, the CENTCOM spokesperson, Major Josh Jacques, he said, we provide refueling totals for the Saudi-led coalition on an on-demand basis. They request refueling, and we provide it. I will refer you to the Saudi-led coalition as to the reasons why they requested the amounts of fuel. So talk about a carte blanche policy. I mean, we're not even, it's just an on-demand basis that we are literally fueling this war, these unlawful attacks on civilian areas. The Saudi-led coalition bombed four Doctors Without Borders hospitals in a single year. And this cholera outbreak is, you know, just man-made. I mean, we're talking about a situation, the reason why they can't stop cholera there is because people don't have access to clean water. And they don't have access to clean water because the Saudi-led coalition is bombing sanitation facilities, sewage treatment facilities, water filtration sites, and as well as bombing food warehouses. And, you know, I mean, it's just destroying society there. It's just destroying the civilian infrastructure.
And who pays for the, Saudi Arabia is not short of oil and aviation fuel. So is the American taxpayer paying for the refueling?
Well, what the American taxpayer is paying for is we're paying Pentagon, employees to refuel these Saudi and Emirati bombers. So they are, and that's what this legislation would go after. So the Davidson Amendment, this is Warren Davidson, he's from Ohio, and he submitted an amendment, Republican, actually in the Freedom Caucus, and he submitted this amendment that would prohibit U.S. military action in Yemen that's not authorized by the 2001 authorization for the use of military force. So to remind your listeners, so the U.S. participation in this Saudi-led war in Yemen is not targeting al-Qaeda. It's not even targeting ISIS. It's not authorized by the 2001 AUMF. And while there's a lot of disagreements about what is authorized by the 2001 AUMF, no one is saying that this is. And so this, so it does. It would cut off, it would block U.S. refueling of Saudi and UAE warplanes that are bombing Yemen. And then the Nolan Amendment, which was also passed overwhelmingly, it prohibits the deployment of U.S. troops to participation in Yemen's civil war. So this would also block U.S. refueling because it's U.S. troops that are now, that are refueling Saudi and UAE warplanes. So both of these amendments together, I mean, they send a very strong message that U.S. support for this devastating, disastrous war has to end.
Well, the U.S. operates across the Red Sea there in a base called Camp Lemantine, I think it's called, where the huge drone presence, and that's where all of the targeting of the so-called al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula goes on. My understanding is that not only has the U.S. been providing the in-air refueling for the Saudi bombers to bomb Yemen, they've also been providing targeting information.
Yeah. That's right. They have. They've provided intelligence, logistical support, targeting information. And really, and this is why these votes were so important, because we don't really know the extent of U.S. involvement in this war. And that's why one thing I did not mention is that Ted Lieu, Congressman Ted Lieu, has really been a leader on this issue. He also had an amendment that would require reporting about from the Pentagon, would require them to submit to Congress information about the extent of U.S. involvement, about what that kind of support for refueling and other kind of military support looks like. So that's the thing. I mean, we've heard. I can tell you, I've talked to some staffers on the Hill, very senior staff, who have been saying that they've heard from the Pentagon that there's not that yes, while there's targeting help, that there's not that the Pentagon is careful about not getting too in-depth with the Saudis about the targeting information, because they're concerned about being liable for, if the Saudis were to be charged with war crimes, they're concerned about U.S. legal liability issues. So, I mean, that's all, just kind of rumors from Capitol Hill, but that's why we need more information. We desperately need transparency, because Americans just have no idea that their taxpayer dollars are going to fund this war where the Saudis are launching these unlawful attacks and plunging Yemen into famine. I mean, we haven't even, that 7 million people are on the verge of starvation, including 500,000 children. Nice. 17 million people are food insecure. They don't know where, their meals, next meals are going to come from. So this is really a catastrophic situation, and it's time for Congress, it's long past time, of course, for Congress to exercise real oversight.
Well, of course, this was the poorest country in the Muslim world, and it's even now been reduced to, bombed back to the Stone Age, as they want to say. Just in closing, though, in the last minute, do you think that this will put a crimp in the Saudi war?
I think this sends a really important signal, and now we have to build on that momentum, because the next hurdle is going through the Senate. And so we need everybody to activate, to call your members of Congress, to call your senators. They're going to consider this legislation. Well, we're not sure exactly, but in the coming weeks, likely, they will consider the Senate version of this big military policy bill, and lots of important issues, including this one, will be at stake. And so we have to make sure that there's a strong Senate vote as well, so that we can get final, legislation that's in the final package of the bill that then goes to the president, and he would be under a lot of pressure to sign this legislation, even if there's very strong language, if there's very strong, accountability measures on the Saudi war in Yemen, because it's the military policy bill, and presidents are if you don't sign that bill, there's a lot of heat. So we have a real opportunity here, and we have to seize this momentum to help end this war.
Well, Kate Gould, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Kate Gould, who's a legislative representative for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies on Iran and Israel-Palestinian peace. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Graham Fitzgibbon and Clemence Pennard. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.